Trump's border wall would cost the U.S. taxpayer, not Mexico, many billions of dollars.
We're looking at spending billions of dollars on a border buildup. And I just wanted to point out what is actually happening before we spend that money that could go to, you know, our schools, our bridges, our infrastructure.
That's Kimball Taylor. We talk with him about his book, The Coyote's Bicycle, The Untold Story of 7,000 Bicycles and the Rise of a Borderland Empire. It shows how human ingenuity and the humble bicycle are defeating the most expensive barrier the U.S. has ever built. Then it's the 75th anniversary of the decree ordering the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II.
We actually started the book with a quote by one of the survivors. His name is Lawson Inada. And he came up with a beautiful quote that I think is the kind of the sub-theme of the whole book. And he wrote, "Only what we could carry was the rule. So we carried strength, dignity, and soul."
That's Richard Kahan. He tells us about his book, Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. It's a collection with text of images by Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, and other government photographers. That's all coming up in today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. A friend of mine is getting deported back to Mexico, a country he hasn't lived in since he was 9 years old. A routine traffic stop and two unpaid traffic tickets from years ago led to his deportation. I can assure you, he's no criminal in any common sense use of the term, but rather a helpful and hardworking young man. I don't know how my friend originally came to the U.S., but I assume he had to cross the U.S. border with Mexico. By the time he crossed, there were already fences at the border. But then, as now, they do little to stop those who are fleeing violence and poverty for a chance at a better life. Now, Donald Trump wants to build a bigger wall. Current cost estimates range from $15 to $25 billion, all paid for by taxpayers. But while it drains the U.S. Treasury of funds that could go to infrastructure we actually need, like repairing America's falling bridges or building mass transit, Trump's wall is unlikely to actually keep people from crossing it. That's what my guest Kimball Taylor wrote last year in his op-ed, "History Shows Trump's Beautiful Wall Would Be Worthless." That conclusion is a result of his investigation into a strange phenomenon. The thousands of bicycles abandoned across the border from Tijuana. Taylor's book, The Coyote's Bicycle, is a story of how those bikes got there, the rise of an ingenious operation smuggling people across the border, and what part is being played by the black market, Hollywood, the prison system, and the military-industrial complex. Taylor also shows that U.S. domestic and foreign policy has a greater impact on immigration than any mere physical barrier can ever have. I started out our interview by asking Kimball Taylor why he thinks Donald Trump's wall won't work.
The research for my book, The Coyote's Bicycle, took me into intimacy with our various walls, fences, roads across the boundary, and that knowledge of the physical structures that are in place and have been growing and building since Jimmy Carter's Carter Curtain, as it was called in 1979, just their physical presence, what has happened to them, the issues that they cause in the landscape, they already illuminate what would happen should a 2,000-mile boundary be built.
So, destined to fail, what are some of the ways that you outline in that article that it would fail?
Well, at the base of it is this idea of prohibition that in the United States, when we don't like something, we tend to legislate prohibition. But when you prohibit something that already has a market, like low-wage labor, when you legislate a prohibition, you only add artificial value to that market. And perversely, the more money you put into enforcement, the more enforcement agents, the more boundaries, the more technology, the more value you pump into that market, which only incentivizes the smugglers to become more creative, more professional, and more efficient. Now, that's the underlying idea, but when you get up close to the wall, you see there's sections of the new fence that was built under the 2007 Secure Fence Act that already have more holes, as I describe in the book, than a pair of hobo pants. Smugglers are literally taking arc welders and cutting out holes the size of garage doors, welding hinges onto the piece that they've cut out, and welding that back in place and accessing it over and over again. You can go onto YouTube and see videos that smugglers have posted, one of which has them jacking up a section of our fence, which costs us an average of over $3 million per mile, jacking it up with a $24 car jack and having people rush under and then kicking the car jack out and sweeping out their tracks with palm fronds, laughing the entire time. So what I'm saying is this underlying equation of adding artificial value to markets that already exist before a prohibition, it creates this overwhelming creativity. And Border Patrol agents that I talk to say, we are always on the offense because they're the creative ones and we're the defenders. And we're, you know, and that's just the way that the whole thing works. And I would just say in total, manufacturing a solution at the actual boundary is the worst place that you could make a solution to whatever issues that we see in this debate. All of the complex components of the immigration issue, they go way back, and they have to do with economic situations, they have to do with economic policies, and they have to do with our foreign policy and our history of foreign policy.
Yeah, in fact, you point out what you call a kind of confluence of factors that combine to create this border / immigration crisis: U.S. immigration policy, globalization, by which you mean trade deals and other and currency crises, and I think there was a third one, but I don't remember what it is right now.
Well, yeah, for some reason in this country, our view of history is just so short that when we get a wave of child migrants at the border, as we did in Texas, we just somehow in the media can't connect that to the very real conflicts that were fueled by the Reagan administration in the 80s. I mean, if you count back the generations, you'll see that those children are literally the children of conflicts that we helped to inflame. And so, you know, when these children get to our borders, we just act like, oh, you know, those are just random children. When actually, you know, I have a friend in Texas who said, those are our kids. We helped create those situations, and those kids have come to our doorstep because they're ours.
In fact, that's something I've thought about: the earlier waves of migration, immigration, poverty that condemned so many kids to, you know, having to go into lives of crime basically to support themselves and their families, kids as they grew up. Then they get deported back to places like El Salvador and Honduras, where you have this huge explosion of gangs, which now is driving even more immigrants across our borders. Although, as you point out, that immigration is actually down. But nonetheless, these kids that are fleeing, they're fleeing, you know, they're refugees from a situation that in some ways we have created.
Yeah. I mean, we've had a hand in every big migration to the United States from our southern border. You're right. Migration has been down since 2008. We've actually had negative migration numbers, more people going back to Mexico and Central America than are actually crossing. And that can be confusing when we do get waves like the child migrants. But in total, the numbers are down. And there's studies that say that people tend to migrate in a certain age range, from your early teens, say, or your late teens to your early 30s. And when we had our housing boom in the mid-aughts, 2004, 2005, 2006, that actually corresponded with a youth boom in Mexico. So there was a lot of young people that were ready to fill the low-wage jobs that our housing boom had created. But since the recession, that youth boom in Mexico has actually aged out of the ages when people migrate, and the most likely they will all stay home. And I want to point that out because we're looking at spending billions of dollars on a border buildup. If any type of immigration reform comes to the table, there's forces that will immediately want money added to enforcement, be it doubling the Border Patrol, which has been called for, or the 2,000-mile wall, or more technology. And I just wanted to point out what is actually happening before we spend that money that could go to, you know, our schools, our bridges, our infrastructure.
So, and you pegged the cost of Trump's wall at about $25 billion. Is that right?
Well, those are estimates, and there hasn't been one structure along the boundary that has stayed within its budget. So it's hard to know even until the job is actually done, but it's quite expensive. There was a section of the fencing here in San Diego that was just a matter of a couple miles that cost $55 million. So prices vary, and even the structures themselves vary. What can be built in, you know, our surging mountains and plummeting canyons, it all varies. But I would like to point out that I didn't set out to become a border expert. I'm a writer who writes about ocean issues mostly, and in 2008 I got an assignment to cover the phenomenon of thousands of car tires that wash across the boundary on the Tijuana River from Mexico into the United States every time we get a big rain. And I went down to the Tijuana River Valley, which is the American Valley just on the other side of Tijuana, and despite the fact that there's metropolises like Tijuana and San Diego on either side, this American Valley is very rural, and there's horse ranches and organic farms and state parks, county parks. And I was talking to a rancher who was picking up these car tires as we talked, and we were talking about the circularity of their journey because they were actually American tires that had been shipped across the boundary, and the river brought them back. And he said, it's just like the bicycles. And I said, what are you talking about, bicycles? And he said, come here. And we walked around his barn. He had a giant pile of bicycles. He said he collected 1,000 bicycles in the last 6 months, and they were just abandoned on his land and in the landscape. I said, where did they come from? And he turned around and he pointed up the hill at Mexico, because Tijuana is actually 300 feet higher in elevation than the American Valley below. And he said, the Mexicans. Well, the thing that made this interesting was not only the volume of abandoned bicycles, but the fact that he was indicating the most enforced 5 miles of our 2,000-mile boundary. The boundary between San Diego and Tijuana has often defined how we look at the entire border, and it's received the most attention, and it has the most technology and the biggest barriers. There's laser tripwires in the landscape. There's infrared cameras. There's seismic sensors. And here it was, every day in and day out, abandoned bicycles were being discovered along this entire stretch from the San Ysidro port of entry to the Pacific Ocean.
And why? Why bicycles?
Well, that, you know, I walked into this pile of bicycles and it just lit my imagination and it just lit my curiosity. And not only me, I mean, looky-loos were coming from all around to have a look at these piles of abandoned bicycles. And I wondered, well, why was this successful, as you pointed out? What was happening? Was it a trend? Were regular people in Tijuana just deciding to grab average bikes and cross? Or was it organized? And if it was organized, was there a central character? Was there a central group? And those are the questions that put me on a 4 to 5 year binge of research and involving myself in communities that I never would have meshed with, be it enforcement or actual smugglers or people just crazy about bicycles.
And therein lies the tale. If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Kimball Taylor about his book, Coyote's Bicycle, The Untold Story of 7,000 Bicycles and the Rise of a Borderland empire. But again, the question, why did they use bicycles? I mean, can't bicycles be picked up just like people in cars?
Well, the bicycles have a lot of characteristics that makes them ingenious for crossing the boundary. And I wouldn't find out the full extent of that for a long time. Earlier in the conversation, you mentioned the plight of people who are forced to come to the boundary for economic reasons. And once I started going into Mexico to find out why the bicycle crossing was successful, I soon learned the legend of a people smuggler named El Indio. And he was a young man. When he was a child, he lived in a tiny little village in Oaxaca. And his two older brothers and his two older sisters had migrated to the United States. And at one point, his parents said, hey, listen, we're going to go to the United States, and we're going to live with your brothers and sisters. And if we're successful in making money, then we'll send for you. If we're not, then we'll return. But in the meantime, they were going to pay for him to go to middle school, which is not common in that area. And he was going to live with his elderly grandfather. Well, in the interim, the grandfather died. He finished his schooling. He'd lost communication with his parents. That period of time in rural Mexico was quite desperate. There was a number of economic crises. Even eating meat was just a rare treat. Mostly kids ate local fruit. And once this character, El Indio, came of age, he realized, well, he had a decision to make. Does he go to the boundary and try to find his parents, not knowing what that entails, not knowing the border cities, not knowing that culture even? Or does he stay and just languish in this village? Well, he decided to leave. He went to Tijuana, as many rural migrants do, and he encounters this situation that is almost set up to, well, is set up to take advantage of them, as poor as they might be. And he wandered the fence line from the mountains to the ocean, trying to figure out how he might cross, what that might entail. And as he does that, he meets all of the characters that are involved in the crossing enterprise. And he comes upon this idea of the bicycle. I do point out in the book that in his village, there was only two machines. One was a tractor that the owner rented out to people for farming if they could afford it. The other was a milkman's bicycle for making deliveries. And it was this kid's job after his parents had left to deliver milk on this bicycle. I point that out because of his intimate experience with the bicycle, but I don't know that that's what spurred his idea of crossing via bicycle, because it was a very complex undertaking that had a lot of factors.
But you say that the bicycles are actually not detected in the same way that other kinds of movement. I mean, are they less detectable than footfall?
Well, this is something that we should think about when we think about employing technologies on the boundary. Every technology that we employ has a hack. The laser tripwires and the infrared cameras, for example, they go totally blind in our sea fogs that we have frequently. And smugglers manipulate those situations. We also have a string of 18,000 seismic sensors that are buried in the ground along the boundary. And seismic, you can imagine, detects earth-shaking things, running, plodding, walking. And traditionally, migrants walked and ran, whereas Border Patrol rolled in their quads, in their kilo trucks, sometimes on bike. And so this technique of crossing via bicycle reversed that trend. Suddenly, the bicycles were not detected by the seismic sensors.
So can you give us a sense of how it feels to actually be a migrant crossing into the U.S. by bicycle?
Well, every smuggler earns his name with the technique that he or she uses. There was people who employed jet skis to go around the sea fence, or there was even little submersible submarines. There's an expert in rope ladders. They would throw a hook up onto the top of these very tall fences and walls, and they would climb these ropes, and they'd straddle the boundary, and they'd throw the rope down the other side and climb down. And as I mentioned, there was people who would cut holes in the iron or steel fencing. And so every coyote earned his reputation with his technique. And when the migrants would come to the boundary, they would, in this instance, they would hear about this character, El Indio, who was crossing people via bicycle. And there was even times when the migrants didn't know how to cross bicycle, and El Indio had people there to teach people how to ride a bicycle before the crossing. So their experience on bike was thrilling. They said it was scary. There was, kind of wheeling into the unknown and crossing this fortified landscape. So, I was told it was both thrilling and scary.
Thrilling and scary. Yeah, I can imagine. So talk more about this coyote trade. Yeah, how many people does it take to cross one person from or a group from Mexico to the U.S.? And what are some of the different roles that the coyotes play?
This is one of the most fascinating lines of research that I found, was that the trade is very stratified, and there's defined roles. There's a surveillance specialist, because they watch the Border Patrol as closely as the Border Patrol watches them. There's a communication specialist, a guy who or a woman who calls the levantón, the pickup driver, at the right time. There is the guías, the guides who actually do the crossing. There's a character called the gancho, who is almost like a rodeo clown. He will cross onto the U.S. side, and he will make a show of himself, and he'll get the attention of the Border Patrol. And as the Border Patrol chases him in one direction, the guías, the guides, will be waiting with their migrants, or pollos, as they call them, in another location, and they will cross into the landscape, hoping to meet their pickup driver. At the top of all of this is the coyote, the head of this of the smuggling operation.
And the coyote, of course, is a venerated figure in American mythology, someone who can outwit, an animal that can outwit all others. But I think the image of coyotes that a lot of us have is that they're ruthless people who are just out for the buck and are going to, just leave people to their fate. Did you find that there was, is this a true picture? Are they really, kind of like the worst kind of criminal gang members, or, is it more nuanced?
People speak about generations of coyote, and that the original coyotes, which they came into being not long after the guest worker program called the Bracero program ended, they had this ethic of caretaking, of ensuring their client's safety and making sure that they got to their destination, because it just makes great business sense. If you cross someone successfully and they're happy with the way they were treated, they will call their brothers and their sisters and cousins and uncles and aunts and say, hey, I crossed with this person. They used this technique and it worked out great. Get in touch with this person. There is also other facets of the crossing trade that ensure a kind of fairness, and that's one of those aspects is that the coyote is paid in the United States. So if a migrant crosses with a guide and they're caught and sent deported back to Mexico, well, that the fact that the migrant hasn't paid ensures other chances to cross until that they're successful and the coyote's paid. That said, there's been other generations that have come along, people that didn't have the expertise, people that were just out to make a buck. You hear terrible stories that have happened in our deserts. Alberto Urrea wrote a book called The Devil's Highway, which details a group of migrants who were taken advantage of and guided across the boundary with inexperienced guides in searing climates. And There was a lot of fatalities. So that is definitely an aspect, but there still is this ethos in certain cities and in certain cultures of caretaking. And that was one of the things that built El Indio's legend, is that he, El Indio, the bicycle coyote, he wanted to look after his people and make sure that their experience was good and that they were successful. And another aspect that I learned is that these smugglers, the successful ones, are quite proud of being able to help out their countrymen into a better life or a better economic situation. So, yes, there, this image of the coyote as a criminal who's only out for himself, that does have a basis in reality, but also there is this kind of historic idea of caretaking the migrants that exists in that community. And I would like to point out, you don't get 11 million people in the United States if it's that terribly difficult and dangerous.
Now, you also uncovered corruption at the border. You know, talk about the money. Talk about how much money both the coyotes get and where it goes.
Well, everyone is paid along the way. I mentioned all the different stratified roles, but also enforcement people are paid. Police in border cities are often get a cut from the number of crossers to look the other way. And police, actually, they do. One of the jobs is the recruiter in the smuggling operation, where these freelancing recruiters will go to the bus station or they'll go to the boundary itself and they'll look for campesinos, poor farmers, people recently arrived. They'll sell them on the services of a certain coyote, and this recruiter will quote-unquote sell that pollo, which translates to chicken, to the coyote. And the reason I mention that is because police will often take that role, too. Police will, in their day-to-day routines, might see a poor-looking migrant or someone who is wandering the boundary line, and they would take them into custody, and they'll find a migrant or they'll find a coyote that they know, and they will sell that migrant to the coyote. So everyone gets paid along the way, and I mentioned the market dynamics earlier. It also affects our own Border Patrol. I covered the case of two Border Patrol agents who were smuggling migrants in their own Border Patrol vehicles. And I'd heard about this before I even knew about the case. It was called Guaranteed, the Guaranteed Crossing. And it was quite expensive. It was in this case, it was $12,000 to cross in a Border Patrol vehicle, which was the first class ticket. But the money that we're artificially injecting into this marketplace with our enforcement and our prohibitions, and instead of managing the issue, that finds its way into every facet of border life.
So one of the things that came to my mind was these folks who you were talking to have an awful lot to lose. They're in a very precarious situation. Why were they willing to talk with you?
Well, I mentioned before that the bicycle itself, like that its connection with childhoods, with independent movement. It's the first time we ever get the sensation of travel without a foot or a hoof on the ground. And it just opened up these stories, the fact that the humble bicycle was defeating the La Migra and the border enterprise. It opened up stories. People would laugh, and they would want to tell their stories. But there was another aspect, and that is that migrants themselves, they feel so forgotten and so overlooked, that when you ask them questions about their life and their experience and their hopes and their fears, it opened up a lot of opportunities to get this story.
Wow. And did you ever feel vulnerable or frightened yourself? Did you think maybe, you might poke in somewhere where you weren't really wanted?
Well, yes, of course. I was asking questions about a dangerous business during a dangerous time. the drug wars that raged in our border cities across the boundary. They were in full effect when I started asking questions about bicycles. But there was a lot of trust built up between the sources, my sources, and I. And we just had to negotiate this really interesting and difficult relationship between an American, me, who my sources weren't sure of. You know, they weren't sure I was actually a writer. There was one instance when I had given a source a book that I had written with my picture on it to prove that I was a writer. But then these questions came up like, well, couldn't, you know, if you were working in enforcement, couldn't they one-off a book just like this with your picture on it? So I realized it's so much more difficult to prove what you're not than to prove what you are. And it was just the duration of my research. It was over several years, and then the way that I was able to build relationships that I think engendered a trust that wouldn't have been there.
Could you say more about that? How did you build trust?
It was extremely difficult. My greatest source and my greatest ally was a guy named El Negro, who turned out to be an amazing researcher himself. And he said he just saw a passion in my eyes when we talked about the bicycles. And it had to do also with my entry into this world. I met people through other people who had been trusted. So, you know, there was this, people talk about synchronicity, but I think that when you start asking questions that you have a genuine interest in without an agenda, that worlds tend to open up for you. And that's the only way that I can explain that in some instances, as in meeting El Negro, I met the only people who could have helped me with this story, not just someone who knew something of it, but the only person that could have linked certain facts.
Well, that's a great story. And I know what you mean. I've had that same experience. It is kind of magical. Kimball Taylor, your latest book is The Coyote's Bicycle, The Untold Story of 7,000 Bicycles and the Rise of a Borderland Empire. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca.
Kimball Taylor writes for Surfer Magazine and is the author of Return by Water and Drive Fast and Take Chances. To read excerpts from The Coyote's Bicycle and see Taylor's photos of the border, go to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk about Un-American, the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. Stay tuned after the break.
No puedo vivir aquí, no puedo vivir allá. Señores, ¿cuándo tendremos un poquitito de paz? Señores, ¿cuándo tendremos un poquitito de paz? Hoy vivo aquí en la Mampleza, frente a un palo de coyol. Pa' no morirme soñando, cantemos esta canción. Pa' no morirme soñando, cantemos esta canción. No human being is illegal, te lo digo, compañero. No human being is illegal, que lo sepa el mundo entero.
Voice, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 75 years ago, President Franklin Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066. With that order, the federal government began the forced incarceration of 110,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry. They were taken from their homes and communities and put into concentration camps out of the mistaken fear that they posed a threat to national security. The federal government sent some of America's greatest photographers to document the forced removal and incarceration. Among them were Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams. Now these photographs from our national archives have been collected into a stunning visual record of that terrible time, along with text by my guest Richard Cahan and his co-author Michael Williams. The book is Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. Richard Cahan is a journalist and publisher of City Files Press. A previous book by him is Vivian Meyer, Out of the Shadows. I started out by asking Richard Cahan what led him to put together his book, Un-American.
Well, I guess it started because of ignorance. I grew up in the Midwest, and the farther you get from California, I think the less you know about the incarceration. I went to high school, learned a lot about World War II, about D-Day, and about the Yalta Conference, and I don't think that the incarceration of Japanese Americans ever came up in high school. And as I, you know, grew up, I learned little bits and pieces of it, but I was always interested in it, never felt that I had a firm understanding of it, and that I thought the idea of learning more about it was something that really appealed to me as a writer.
And these photos, how did you gain access to them?
Well, they actually belong to all of us. They were taken by, most of the photos were taken by photographers who were hired by the government, and they're housed at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, and many of them are now online. And the photographs that were taken by Ansel Adams, the great landscape photographer of the West, were a little different. He was authorized to photograph one of the 10 internment camps in Manzanar, the camp in Manzanar. He spent on and off over a year at the camp, and after he was finished, he donated his photographs to the Library of Congress. And by doing that, they too belong to the government, and they belong to all of us.
Now, I was interested to see that you actually start with language. What are the right words to use in dealing with the incarceration, starting with that word incarceration itself? I wonder if you could tell our listeners about the caution that you write in the book about language.
As I mentioned, this was very much a learning experience for me, and I hope for the readers of the book. I had always heard of referred to this period of American history as the internment of Japanese Americans. And as I was working on the book, I was warned by many Japanese Americans and scholars that internment was not the correct, precise used to word. In fact, besides being precise, it was wrong, because when somebody is interned, that means that a government is putting in custody a citizen. And 70,000 of the 110,000 Japanese Americans who were forcibly removed were U.S. citizens. So it really wasn't an internment. It was a forcible removal or incarceration. And as a writer and as a publisher, I was very concerned about not using the word internment because, as you know, we live in this world of keywords, and keywords are very important in getting people to our websites and to our books. But one of the survivors, asked me, why do you start your book with a lie? And it was a question that I couldn't answer, so I changed the subtitle of the book. It's now titled Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. But there were other words that are commonly used that I learned were just the wrong words. Oftentimes, this movement of people is called an evacuation. And of course, evacuation connotes that there was a storm or there was a tragedy or that the government was helping people get to safety, which, of course, you know, nothing could be farther from the truth. And actually, even the word relocation, you know, when you talk about relocation, you generally talk about kind of a voluntary move. You know, you're relocating to another job. You're not being forced to go somewhere. And so instead of using relocation, again, we used incarceration. And the list really went on and on. I learned that, you know, there's a phrase that history belongs to the victors, and I'm learning that language, too, belongs to the victors.
And about the forced removal, the incarceration of Japanese Americans, give us an overview, a brief orientation. I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners know what happened, but not the details.
Well, all this began on Pearl Harbor Day, when Japan attacked, the government of Japan attacked our naval bases at Pearl Harbor, and over more than 2,000 Americans died in that attack. And immediately, that started a great worry in America of the Japanese Americans that lived here. Also, there was a worry of the Germans and the Italians that lived here. But the Japanese Americans were particularly vulnerable because there was a worry that Japan would attack the West Coast, and the Japanese Americans that lived here would spy for them, that they would collaborate with them, and they would wreak sabotage in the name of the mother country. In fact, there was such a worry that 2 days after Pearl Harbor, that Monday night, there was actually a blackout drill in San Francisco. So there were real, true concerns about the Japanese-Americans that lived along the West Coast. There were about 115,000 Japanese-Americans living there then of 125,000 that lived in the entire country. So more than 90% of all Japanese-Americans, they had not moved into America at the time. And that's where problems began, because there was a feeling that they should be, you know, watched very closely. They should be isolated. They should be put in concentration camps. And that was a real learning experience for me, because I realized that America, and I'm sure that other countries go through the same problem, it's probably a human thing, have a problem with identifying their true enemies. The true enemies of World War II was the government of Japan, the government of Germany and Italy. It wasn't those people who lived in America. And I see similarities now. If we do have enemies, if ISIS is an enemy, it is not Muslim Americans that are living here right now. So I think that was one of the first learning, one of the first takeaways that I learned. And on February, 75 years ago, on February 20th, 1942, Franklin Delano Roosevelt made a very fateful decision, Executive Order 9066, and he let the military decide the fate of Japanese Americans. And at first glance, that might make a lot of sense. The military was in charge of the security of the country, but when you think about it again, the military did not care about the civil liberties of these people. They were their only strategy was to keep America safe. And I think that this book really shows what happens when fear eclipses civil liberties, when the military, in a sense, takes over to make decisions that should be made by leaders.
Yes, and it was terribly devastating, as is witnessed by the photographs. The first photo in the book, other than the cover, is of a prosperous farmer and his family. It's a photo that was taken by the very famous photographer for the Farm Labor?
Farm Security Administration.
The Farm Security Administration. That was Dorothea Lange. Tell us about this photo and the family and what happened to them.
Sure. I want to make sure that everybody knows who Dorothea Lange is. I think people do know who she is, but I'll just remind. So Dorothea Lange was a photographer. She was a documentary photographer, born in the East and moved to San Francisco. And she was most noted for her government work documenting the migration of what we call Okies, to California, and very famous for her picture of the migrant mother, the woman who's in a shanty tent, she's surrounded by her children. And I would say about one-third of the pictures in this book were taken by Dorothea Lange. She had this very unique ability to penetrate, to photograph the essence of people, to get so close that all of a sudden we get the sense that we can look into their eyes and look into their souls. And this picture was a very important one because it shows a family. It was the Matari family in Northern California, just sitting on their stoop before they were removed. And a key to this book is that we were able to track down, figure out, identify, and interview about 25 subjects in the book. And one of the subjects was this woman who's photographed in the book, and her name at the time was Jean Mitre. And I found her in the phone book. She now lives in Salt Lake City. She was a college professor, retired college professor. She's 85. And I said, do you remember the day that Dorothea Lange came to photograph your family? And she said, I remember it very well, because my father was a prosperous, had a mechanicalized farm in California. And I remember after she came, she wanted to take pictures of my sister and my family, but we couldn't find the shoes of my one-year-old baby sister. And my father was very upset because he didn't want us to look like hayseeds. And I looked at the picture very closely, and there's the little baby sitting on her mother's lap, and later in the book, in Jean's arms, and she has no shoes on. And so I realized the little and big details that make these pictures important, the historic details and the artistic beauty of them. And the stories behind them are really important because people got a chance to tell me what happened that day, what happened leading up to the picture, and what happened in their lives afterwards.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Richard Cahan about his photographic exploration of the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. The book is Un-American. Now, Dorothea Lange was quite disturbed by what she was photographing. I wonder if you could talk about her reaction and that of other photographers to what they were seeing.
This was not an easy thing to witness or to photograph. Dorothea Lange lasted for only 3 months as the first photographer working for the War Relocation Authority. That was the agency that was established. And her assistant recalled that one day, about 2 months into it, or 1.5 months into it, she was in a hotel in Woodland, California, photographing trains leaving from Woodland. In fact, the cover picture is the picture that she photographed that day. And she was in a state of nervous paroxysm. She had a nervous breakdown. She just couldn't go on. She didn't like what she was seeing, and she didn't know how to respond. And she responded the only way she knew how to do it is by taking these very evocative, important photographs. And interestingly, I had a chance to also talk to the families of two of the other photographers who were hired by the government. I'm sorry, one of the other photographers hired by the government. And he, too, quit because he just couldn't stomach what was going on. This was a very hard time for people. In fact, Milton Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower's brother, who ran the War Relocation Authority at first, quit just a couple months into it. Because, again, he said he couldn't sleep at night. He didn't like what his own agency was doing. So not an easy time for America on both sides.
Another photographer, a very famous one, who was a part of this project, and you mentioned him before, was Ansel Adams. Of course, the very famed photographer who took the photographs of Yosemite Valley. There was a controversy that swirled around the way he did, the way he photographed the Japanese Americans who were incarcerated in the camps.
Right, and actually that controversy continues today, and it keeps kind of ebbing and flowing in critics' assessment of his work. So Ansel Adams, at the time, was a nature photographer, and he was a part of the Sierra Club, and one of his fellow Sierra Club members was a man by the name of Ralph Merritt, who was the director of one of the 10 camps, Manzanar. And Ralph Merritt invited Adams to come to the camp and show the conditions there. And Adams accepted. And his photographs, he came to the camp in 1943, so it had been open for over a year. People who lived there had adapted they had evolved quite a bit since those first days when Dorothea Lange photographed them. And he shows people in a very dignified, heroic posture, and he photographs the landscape, the beautiful landscape around Manzanar, and he says that landscape, he's sure, helped those people get through these hard years. He shows the photographs at the New York's Museum of Modern Art, and they're shown in the basement, and he's harshly criticized in late 1944 for exactly that, for showing the humanity of these people. He ended up dying, saying that this was his absolute most important work. And now when his photographs are shown, they're criticized for other reasons. They're criticized for not showing the harsh conditions in the camp. And Ansel Adams wrote while he was still alive that he looked for those harsh conditions, and he looked for those kind of people down and out, but he never found them. He felt that what was really overwhelming to him was the strength and the dignity that these people, and that's what he portrayed. So it's kind of a no-win situation. Dorothea Lange thought who was a good friend of Ansel Adams, thought he had glamorized the whole thing, and Ansel Adams thought that Dorothea Lange had done the opposite, had kind of created a sociological, kind of a grim sociological photo report of those early days. So I think between those two photographers, I think we run a nice wide gamut to get a sense of what was going on.
Yes, and as you just pointed out, I mean, in fact, the inmates did confront a terrible situation with tremendous grit and courage, and actually did everything they could to make the conditions in the camp as good as possible for them. They treated each other, their doctors treated people. They built, they tried to make a home there in those terrible conditions. So talk a little bit about the difficulties they confronted. Tell us some of those stories and, sure. and some of the things they accomplished.
Somebody recently asked me, as I was talking about my book, whether I really felt sorry for Japanese Americans, and I was very much taken aback because they lived through an incredibly difficult time. They were picked up from their homes and put on buses and in army convoys and on trains and taken to what were temporary camps. They were oftentimes in horse tracks and on county farms, and when they were on horse tracks, some of them were actually made to sleep in the stalls that the racehorses had been sleeping in. Others were placed in very poorly constructed army barracks, things that looked like army barracks. The permanent centers were in the middle of deserts, usually, or in the forest of Arkansas. There was cold winds. Most of their shelters had one light bulb. They ate in communal mess halls. They had very little privacy in their bathrooms. They weren't paid for their work, or they were paid a pittance for their work. And the camps were surrounded by barbed wire and soldiers with guns. So this was a very difficult time. They were not told how long they would be taken. They were not told where they would be taken. And we actually started the book with a quote by one of the survivors. His name is Lawson Anada, who was the poet laureate of Oregon, and he came up with a beautiful quote that I think is the kind of the sub theme of the whole book. And he wrote, "Only what we could carry was the rule, so we carried strength, dignity, and soul." And I think that's really a lot of the story of the incarceration.
And there was also resistance. Talk about some of the unrest and resistance that actually occurred in the camps themselves.
I was surprised at how little resistance there was before the incarceration began. Many Japanese Americans felt that this was their way of contributing to the war effort, and many had a real aversion to questioning and fighting authority. But as the years continued, there was more and more resistance, and that really culminated, and you'll see a very different camp at the end of the book. But it culminated at the Tule Lake Camp in Northern California, which was a camp that was called a segregation camp because many of the people who ended up in Tule Lake were people who, according to the government, had not shown their true allegiance to America. Now, you can imagine after a couple of years, if you're asked to take a loyalty oath for America and you've been put in a camp surrounded by barbed wire and soldiers, your allegiance is tested a little bit, and many people refused to either sign a loyalty oath to the United States or just didn't want to participate at all. They felt they were citizens and there was absolutely no reason for that. And so they were taken to Tule Lake and put into these camps. This was an exceedingly difficult couple of years, several years, for all Japanese Americans. And it's a trauma that many have never forgotten.
Now, many of them, after I don't even think they had to wait entirely till the war ended. When were the camps? When were people released from the camps?
People could leave the camps in 1942, 43, and 44. If they could find a college in the Midwest or the East that would accept them if they were college age. Several thousand left because of that, and several tens of thousands left because they found communities and sponsors away from the West Coast where they could work. Usually they left for farming. But the vast majority stayed until 1945, until near the end of the war. And the camps were finally opened at the very, very end of 1944. The Supreme Court was on the verge of ruling that what happened to the Japanese Americans was unconstitutional. And the day before the courts were going to announce it, Franklin Delano Roosevelt opened the camps and said there was no more security risk. So it's unfortunate that Supreme Court decision didn't come down, because that would have finalized, that would have made this whole experience a legal precedent that would be considered illegal, but that never happened. Other lawsuits did help make that happen, but the camps were finally opened, I think, the January 1st or 2nd of 1945, and it was a slow process for people to leave. Many were still in the camps until October of 1945, when the war was, you know, over.
And what did they find when they came back, for those who did go back to their communities? What had been the response of many of their Anglo neighbors?
Well, it was a very difficult time. Oftentimes they went back to their homes. Sometimes they found that other people were living in their homes, and they had to go to the sheriffs to get their homes back. Most people obviously had rentals, so they didn't have that problem. But farms had often been vandalized. Crops were dead. For so many, they had to start over. Many people did not want to return to California. Chicago became one of the many centers of people. It had a population of 400 Japanese Americans before the war and over 20,000 a few years after. So many wanted to strike out and start a new life away from California and away from the West Coast. But it was a traumatic time. We spoke to one man who was photographed, who remembers his family going back to California at night. At midnight, some vigilantes started shooting up their house. There were dozens of reports of that. They had lots of problems finding even a church that would welcome them, because when they tried one church, the pastor said, "It's okay for you to come to our church, but no other neighbors. Everyone else will leave the church if you do come." So they found another church, and it was a hard time. And many of them, you know, all of them had lost their livelihood, and they were starting over again. Remarkably, when I talked to many people, I asked them, "So what did you do afterwards?" And so many of them, males were gardeners and females worked as domestics.
Wow. And they had, you know, they had built themselves up before the war under conditions of extreme prejudice, often to prosperous communities. So this was really starting over at square one.
They had. I don't like to stereotype, but on the whole, Japanese Americans before the war had produced remarkable farms, mostly because they had worked so hard at them. And they were certainly getting a leg up into the American middle class.
Now, there was, I don't remember if it was Earl Warren or someone else who you know, had been part of this, who said, "If you think this isn't going to happen again, you're wrong." Talk about the threat of this happening again, especially in the era of Trump.
Well, it's interesting. The person who actually said that was Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who just died. And in 2014, not that long ago, he told a class of Hawaii law students, he said, when talking about the internment, he said, "You're kidding yourself if you think that the same thing cannot happen again." And then he used the quote of Cicero, who once said, "In times of war, the laws fall silent." And his point is that when we're scared, when we're at war, we don't abide by our rational legal decisions. And I think that's something that is endemic to our society, and I'm sure, going back to Cicero, it's endemic to civilization at all. When we get scared, we make irrational decisions and decisions that really aren't lawful. And I think that's something that we need to remember at all times now.
Well, Richard Kahan, your beautifully produced book, Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, is a cautionary tale that we really all need to take very much to heart. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Richard Kahan. Go to writersvoice.net to see some of the photos in Un-American. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.